Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast for August 14th, 2012. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and today I'll be speaking with Douglas Emlyn about a signaling pathway that's involved in regulating the growth of the male rhinoceros beetle's horn. Male rhinoceros beetles use their horns to fight one another for access to mates, much like male deer and elk use their antlers to fight for dominance over a group of females. Males with the largest horns generally win more fights, and so they go on to produce more offspring. In some other species, males have ornaments that are useful not as weapons, but for attracting mates, like the trains of peafowl or birds of paradise. In these species, the females choose mates based on the size and the color of that tail. A large, showy tail indicates that the male is physically fit enough to grow a big tail that has no real practical function, except, of course, for attracting females. Male ornaments and weapons like these are said to be under sexual selection because these structures don't contribute to the individual's survival, but they do affect their reproductive success or fitness. It takes a lot of energy to grow and maintain structures like these, so the ability to grow large ornaments or weapons may indeed reflect the physical quality of the male. Doug Emlyn's group has just completed a story in which they found that the insulin signaling pathway is important for determining the size of the rhinoceros beetle's horn, and they hypothesize that this same pathway might also be important for regulating the growth of sexually selected male ornaments and weapons in other species. Emlyn spoke to me by telephone from the University of Montana.
And what I'll say at the outset that I appreciated that you got right in that intro is that there are essentially two types of sexually selected structures. It's a blurry line in some cases with some systems, but there are lots of showy ornaments that meet all the same criteria that we're going to talk about here for the weapons and the beetles that are used by females as a basis for choosing mates. And then there are weapons that are used by males in contests that also ultimately translate into access to mates. But it's a different behavioral mechanism because the females aren't actively discriminating amongst mates based on the traits. And the beetle horns fall into the category of the weapons.
Male rhinoceros beetles use their horns to fight for access to females. So the size of that horn is important for determining who wins those competitions. But do the females show any preference for a larger horn? Like the way, for example, a peahen shows a preference for a male with a large, showy tail.
In situations like the peacock and the peahen, females pay very close attention to the size and the eye spots on the trains, the tails that the peacocks have. In this case, the females don't appear overtly to pay any attention whatsoever to the weapons in the males. The weapons matter. But they matter for the sorting process by which the males fight over access to the females. And at least from our human-centric view when we watch them, the female seems oblivious to the soap opera around her, and they do not seem to accept or reject males based on the horn. So these are weapons, and weapons proper.
Does the fact that a particular male makes a larger weapon or a more showy ornament than the male next to him really mean that he's truly in better condition?
And I would say yes. So there's a huge field of research looking at these types of structures. They're fun, beautiful, charismatic structures, so people are interested in them for that reason. But they're also sort of shocking characters because they're so extreme, and people are interested in why. How do you get such extraordinary structures in these animals? And that's really where this field of sexual selection comes from. So when you ask that question, there's lots of answers to it. So there's a theoretical research base where people have modeled the evolution of these traits, and again and again and again, they find that the kinds of traits that are most likely to evolve in these types of circumstances are ones where the expression of the trait is somehow or other linked to the quality of the animal. And in fact, the explicit prediction from the theory is that these traits should be more sensitive to condition than other body parts. They should be extra sensitive to nutrition or condition. So then there's a whole body of empirical work where for years and years people have looked at their focal traits, whatever the animal is that they're interested in. They've looked at the tails in the birds, or they've looked at big color patches on the sides of the faces of animals, and they've tried to manipulate the condition of an animal to see if it translates into expression of the trait. So you can immune challenge an individual by injecting parasites or pathogens into it and essentially look at after development whether that animal has stunted or smaller or paler colored display traits. And you can manipulate nutrition. One of the most widespread ways of doing that is you perturb how much food animals get, you give them low nutrition, and what do you know, they end up having really small or stunted structures. So there's theoretical evidence and empirical evidence in the form of sort of challenging individuals and seeing how condition translates into the expression of the traits. And the answer resoundingly is yes, these big showy ornaments are very sensitive to the condition of the animals. What was missing was any actual studies that sort of looked under the hood, so to speak, and said, well, how are these traits conditionally expressed? What is the mechanism that causes poor quality animals to make a really runty, tiny version of the trait and really high quality animals to make a much bigger version of the trait? And so there's been some research looking at color types of ornaments and those mechanisms, but what we've been focusing on are the big things. What makes a trait big? And why is it that big traits tend to be honest signals of the quality of the animal?
You mentioned that a lot of these traits are dependent upon nutrition during development. Is that the case with the beetle horn?
Yes, it is definitely the case with the beetle horn. And that's something that we were able to show a number of years ago and a number of labs have been able to show in one way or another. This seems to be sort of a general rule with these insects. In general, insect development is exquisitely sensitive to nutrition, perhaps more so than people who work on vertebrates are used to thinking about. You can take flies, you can take beetles, and if you give them either poor quality food or, as we often do, just low quantities of food, you're going to end up with individuals that are much, much smaller. I mean, half the size of animals that you get from the same population, from the same parents, so the same genetic background. You get much bigger animals if you just give them access to much better nutrition. So insects are sort of already really tuned into nutrition. And then what you find with things like the weapons is that they're even more sensitive to nutrition than the other traits.
So low nutrition disproportionately affects the weapon. It affects body size as well, but it affects the weapon even more so.
Precisely. The horns are very sensitive to nutrition. It's something that's been shown again and again in pretty much any beetle species that's been looked at. The weapons are very sensitive to nutrition.
The insulin pathway makes a lot of sense to think about in this context because in a lot of other species and a lot of other contexts, insulin signaling functions to couple nutrients with growth.
Yes.
And so you looked at the role of insulin signaling in beetle horn growth. How did you test for involvement of that pathway in the horn growth?
Exactly. So we had an a priori reason to suspect that this pathway might be involved. And I should add as a background on that one too that we've actually thought this pathway might be involved for almost 10 years. It's been a difficult thing logistically for us to actually manage to test. And so a good friend of mine who does amazing work on this pathway in Drosophila, Alex Shingleton, from Michigan State University, had already sort of set the stage here because he also has been interested in how insulin signaling affects growth of structures, traits like wings or genitalia, and how it leads to the nutrition sensitivity of expression of those traits. And so Alex had already focused on wings versus genitalia and said, well, these two traits are different, same animals, but the genitalia don't respond to nutrition, and the wings do. And he hypothesized that the insulin pathway was involved, and because Drosophila is such a spectacular model system, he's been able to go in with exquisite precision and go in there and systematically test gene after gene after gene in this pathway to see what's potentially different between these two traits. Why do genitalia and wings respond differently to these circulating signals? And that really set the stage conceptually for us trying to do the same thing in beetles. So he was looking at what takes a normal plastic trait like a wing and then makes another trait behave differently from that, become less sensitive. So he was focusing on how you become sort of less sensitive to these signals. We turned it around and said, well, how do you become more sensitive to these signals? And what we were predicting would happen is that these ornaments and weapons would be even more sensitive to the signals than other surrounding traits. So we already had a reason to believe the pathway was going to be involved, and we already had sort of a conceptual framework for what we did based on Alex Shingleton's work looking at wings versus genitalia. But what we set out to specifically test in our case is whether extreme or exaggerated structures like these horns are extra sensitive to insulin, whether they're more sensitive to these signals than other things like wings. So we set out to try to do this. The problem is that beetles are not Drosophila. They take a lot longer to rear in the laboratory, and we don't have the genomics and the transgenic and other genetic tools that are available in the model systems. So we took the plunge, and it actually took us a number of years to get some of these tools in place. So for the rhinoceros beetles, the way we did it was to clone the rhinoceros beetle version of the insulin receptor gene. And once we had the sequence for a big part of that gene, we were able to design double-stranded RNAs to then go into our animals and perturb the activity of that pathway. Now, admittedly, to people that are used to doing cell biology or serious genetics on a model system, this is the developmental equivalent of hitting these things over the head with a sledgehammer. It is not the ultimate precise way of perturbing the system, but we don't have these things coupled to heat shock promoters. We can't turn them on and off in particular tissues. We're sort of stuck with the tools that we have at hand. Oddly enough, we don't even know what the insulins are. So for people that know this pathway, the receptors are very highly conserved, and a lot of the downstream elements of the pathway are extremely conserved across taxa, but the upstream ligands of the receptors are not. Drosophila have 6 insulin-like peptides, and there are vertebrates with many more. And so we don't know yet what the insulin-like peptides are for the beetles. So we couldn't do the obvious experiment of dosing them up with insulin and seeing what happens.
So you just knocked down the insulin receptor.
Exactly.
Throughout the whole animal with RNA interference.
Yes. So it's a sledgehammer, but it's a little bit more precise. It's a sledgehammer hitting a very precise stake, if you will, because we knew when to do it. So what happens is we could go into the whole animal and inject them and knock down the insulin, but we're only knocking it down operationally for about a 48-hour window. But it's a 48-hour window of time out of a 6-month generation time that's strategically timed to coincide precisely with when these adult structures are growing. So then we're asking the simple question. Again, we're basing a lot of this on Alex Shingleton's work. He showed that if you were to perturb the system, genitalia will not respond because they're not sensitive to these hormone signals, but the wings will. So we looked at genitalia, wings, and horns, and we said, okay, do the genitalia not respond, just like they do in fruit flies? Do the wings respond, as the whole body should and as most traits would? And then do the horns respond more? And so we went in and perturbed it with our little sledgehammer, and then we turned around and said, what happened to the growth of these traits? So we're using their response to our interruption of transcript abundance as a proxy for how sensitive they would normally be to the signal. And what we found was the genitalia did not respond, just like we expected based on the Drosophila studies. The wings did respond a little bit, and then the horns responded 8 times more than the wings.
The amount of insulin made in an animal and activity through the insulin signaling pathway is directly affected by nutrition. So then presumably, you know, small differences in nutrition could be translated into differences in insulin signaling, and that could account for the variability that you observe in horn size?
Yes, exactly. So there's lots of literature on vertebrates and invertebrates showing that nutrition is going to have a profound effect on the insulin levels, that the insulin levels will track that. And I'm lumping insulin-like peptides and insulin-like growth factors, or IGFs, because in vertebrates, for sexually selected structures, it may be the IGFs that are actually driving the story. But it's the same basic downstream pathway. So the signal levels reflect nutrition. And then what happens is traits that are sensitive to those signals, their growth is also then sensitive to nutrition. So we would say they're phenotypically plastic. So the genitalia, which are relatively insensitive to the insulin signals, also are not very plastic in their development. Phenotypically plastic. The wings and the body size in general, those things are sensitive to insulin signaling, and they have nutrition-dependent phenotypic plasticity. So nutrition drives the amount of growth of those traits because of the action of this insulin pathway. And then what we're proposing here is that the big extravagant structures, the ornaments and weapons of sexual selection, may often be extra sensitive to these insulin signals. And as a result of their heightened sensitivity to these circulating signals, their growth is therefore more sensitive to nutrition than other structures. And that does translate into increased variability. It means that when conditions are bad and insulin is low, those traits are going to get stunted. Their growth is going to be shut down more than other structures. So you're going to get a teeny, teeny, tiny weapon. And when conditions are really good, since this pathway can stimulate proliferation and these traits are extra sensitive, they're going to get tons of growth. So if they're 8 times more sensitive to the pathway, we're suggesting that under good conditions, those traits are going to grow 8 times as fast as other body parts. And the result of that is an amplified amount of variation in the population. Most of the research on this pathway focuses on nutrition, but there actually are a few fun studies that suggest that stress or infection by parasites and pathogens can depress insulin levels. There's not a lot of studies of this yet, but they're very exciting to me because that's a huge part of the field of sexual selection. A lot of people are interested not just in nutrition, but in the overall condition of animals in terms of resistance to parasites and pathogens too, and stress. So animals with dominance hierarchies where the low-quality males get basically beat up and knocked down in the dominance hierarchy, those animals are under high stress. If these things affect insulin levels too, then these sexually selected structures are truly going to be conditionally expressed traits that reflect all aspects of condition, from nutrition to dominant status to stress to parasites and pathogen loads. That would be very, very cool. But to date, there's not as much work on the links between those other sources of condition and insulin. There's just a few.
That sensitivity to insulin signaling can account for the difference in horn sizes between individuals. How could that sensitivity operate on a population level?
That's the fun twist. So what we're trying to do is take information about a mechanism and then extrapolate it to what would happen as that mechanism unfolds in animal after animal after animal across the population. So if you're used to studying cell biology or developmental biology in model system type research, you're very often looking at what's going on within an individual. And so insulin is extremely important within animals. So if you focus within a single individual, there are going to be good times and bad times. And when it's well fed, you're going to have higher circulating levels of insulin than when it's poorly fed. And so one of the sort of ancestral functions of this pathway may well have been to modulate the amount of tissue growth accordingly, depending on the nutritional state of that animal over time. So you're looking within an individual from time point A to time point B to time point C. They may go through a starvation period at a bad time of year, and everything shuts down. And the way proliferation shuts down is because the insulin levels drop during lean times, and then everything resumes again when nutrition levels get better. So a developmental biologist thinking about insulin may well be thinking of what's going on, you know, moment to moment within a single animal. When we start trying to take these mechanisms and ask and answer questions about evolutionary biology and about sort of the expression of these ornaments in populations, we're switching from a within individual to a within population view. The idea is that the insulin pathway is playing out within every single animal, but you can step back and look at 20 animals, 50 animals, 100 different animals in a population, and they're all going to be dealing with their own environments and their own nutritional histories. And in each one of those individuals, the insulin pathway is going to play out. And what that means, we think, is on average, individuals that are well-fed and in good condition are going to have higher circulating levels of insulin more of the time than individuals that are stressed out or in poor nutritional conditions. The insulin levels may still go up and down within each of those animals, but on average, the circulating levels are going to be higher in well-fed animals than in poorly fed animals. And there's a frame shift there. We've switched from thinking about what's happening over time within an individual to what's happening at any one point in time across a whole bunch of different individuals. And it's the way this mechanism plays out across different individuals within a population that gives us the variation in the amounts of growth of these individual structures, and therefore the variation in the size of the weapon across males in a population.
Thank you, Dr. Emlyn, for speaking with me.
You're very welcome.
That was Douglas Emlyn, first author of a research report released July 26th on Science Express. That paper will appear in the August 17th issue of Science, and it's titled A Mechanism of Extreme Growth and Reliable Signaling in Sexually Selected Ornaments and Weapons. And that wraps up this Science Signaling podcast. If you have any questions or suggestions, please write to us at sciencesignalingeditors@aaas.org. This show is a production of Science Signaling and of AAAS, Advancing Science, Serving Society. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and on behalf of Science Signaling and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for listening.